Leek considered the rational world, and half the time she was a bit of flotsam, carried along on Shade's obsession. Look, Cruz, what if your trans thing is just some mental problem, dysphoria or whatever? What does it matter what the diagnosis is if there's a cure and the cure doesn't hurt anyone? How has anyone got a single damn reason to care how you look or what you call yourself? If you're crazy, the people hating on you are a hell of a lot crazier. That brought a crooked smile to Cruz's lips. Your friend in the Target ladies' room is perfectly sane. Malik went on bitterly. There is not a shrink on earth Shade couldn't convince she's all right. Smart as hell, very good at rationalizing. And yet, look where we are, Cruz. She's sane and smart, and here we are. And I wouldn't bet 10 cents we'll be alive a week from now. So how smart does that make the two of us that we follow her? What the hell is the matter with us? You follow her because you love her, Cruz said. There followed a silence. Then, God damn it, Cruz. Malik lowered his forehead to the steering wheel and banged it softly. It's true, Cruz said. Of course it's true. Jesus, Cruz, you're not supposed to say it. Cruz lay her hand on his shoulder. I'm sorry you're in this mess, Malik, but I'm so glad you're here. Playing the part of the idiot ex-boyfriend, Malik grumbled. The official enabler. Maybe, Cruz said softly, but she needs you and so do I. You can call yourself an idiot, but I would give... Her voice choked, and for a moment she couldn't go on, and when she did, it was in an emotion-roughened tone. I would give anything, anything in the world, to have just one person love me the way you love her. Malik placed his hand over her hand on his shoulder. Then he jerked his chin in the direction of the restaurant. The superhero cometh. Cruz followed the direction of his gaze. I think of her as being half human, half shark. Yep, that'll do, Malik said. All right, Shade announced through the window. California and the hero track it is, right? Because none of us had a better idea. Fait accompli, Cruz said. It took them 2 days and 3 more stolen cars to reach California. En route, they listened to the radio for news reports, and Cruz kept an eye on social media, but there were no new sightings of Nightmare. The Coast Guard stopped the ship Nightmare had snagged at the Golden Gate and found no sign of Nightmare or the woman with him. The ship's crew all agreed that the creature and the woman with him destroyed the ship's radio and forced them to launch a lifeboat just off the coast of the Monterey Peninsula. Shade, Cruz, and Malik approached Monterey, but they turned back when they got word of roadblocks ahead. They spent the night in a motel that accepted cash and monitored both the TV and the web, but there was no news of Nightmare. The next morning they drove 20 miles and found a second motel and again spent a night watching TV and cursing the slow Wi-Fi. At the motel, Kim Kardashian made an appearance. A very complete appearance, since Cruz had full body shots to work with. An appearance that, to Shade's undisguised disgust, managed to stop Malik in mid-sentence, despite the fact that he was prosing away about Eddie Van Halen's guitar work. By the third day of this, the hero option was looking hopeless. They heard of a fire raging in San Luis Obispo, but it was too far away for Shade to pull a dramatic rescue. They considered whether Shade could fly to a war zone and save a bunch of lives, but concluded that the FBI was quite likely to spot them if they bought tickets to Afghanistan. They heard of 2 surfers lost beneath a freak wave, their bodies presumably swept out to sea, but it was hard to see where super speed would be of any help there. They watched The Incredibles and speculated about whether Shade could run on water, like the kid in the movie. And then, a sighting. Nightmare had just emptied a bank vault in Salinas, and that was only 6 miles away. They raced to the scene but stopped well away as the town was crawling with every variety of law enforcement officer. Nightmare's got the same problem we have, Shade said. He can't use credit cards, which means he's either sleeping in the open or hiding out in no-tell motels he can pay for in cash. There are dozens of those within an hour's drive, Malik said, and the police will have figured that out too. Yes, of course they will. And they have the resources, which means we need the same resources. We need to know what the cops know. What if we had a police scanner? Cruz suggested. That's just the public frequency, Malik said. We need a radio tuned to whatever private frequency they're using. Then, to Shade, how far can you run? I don't know, but we could park a couple miles away. That's just a few seconds run. I can go right into Salinas and snag a radio. Might be worth thinking about, Malik mused, but Shade had already transformed, and a second later was out the door. Yes, Malik called after her. It was good to discuss all this and work it out in advance and not just go running off like a... He sighed, sat back, closed his eyes, and said, So Cruz, know any jokes? But before Cruz could think of any, Shade was back and holding a squawking police radio. And I got these. She handed a pack of Smarties to Cruz. Excellent, Cruz said. It took 7 hours of listening to intermittent chatter between a CHP captain, an LAPD commander, an FBI special agent, and a person who was never identified by affiliation before they sat up suddenly. Suspect spotted, southbound PCH, 9 miles north of Piedras Blanca Lighthouse. Map it, Shade snapped to Cruz. We're not far, Cruz reported, and Malik pulled out into traffic. Left at the light, Cruz directed. Suspect vehicle is a light blue Mini Cooper, license plate 2, Golf Able, Tear, 1, 2, 3. Okay, that's straight down PCH, south. You want to go south, Cruz said. South, not north, south. Floor it, Shade said. The cops are too busy to write traffic tickets. Yeah, and maybe the EMTs will be too busy to scrape our bodies up off the freeway. But Malik accelerated anyway. You could run on ahead, Cruz suggested. Shade shook her head. That run to pick up the radio? That about gutted me. And the watchers were... The longer I morphed, the closer they feel. The purloined radio squawked. The fugitives in the Mini Cooper had run off the road as they tried to veer from the highway and presumably find cover in the lighthouse. A CHP helicopter passed low over their heads, rotors tilted, moving at top speed. Behind them came the sound of sirens. Just a mile, Cruz said nervously. Have you thought about how to beat him? Malik asked. Now it occurs to you to ask? I'm fast and I'm strong and I don't bruise easily. That's all I've got, Shade said, her voice pitching upward in excitement and fear. Malik considered. Then, you can use the car, this car. He explained his idea in quick, terse sentences, even as they spotted the lighthouse, a stubby cylinder atop low rocks against the gray and white Pacific. The land on both sides of the road was gently rolling, hay-colored grass on low hills to the left, hay-colored grass on flatter land to their right, the ocean side. There was a sign warning of a curve and advising 40 miles an hour. The CHP helicopter was circling, taking a wide turn from following the highway to following the access road leading out to the lighthouse. Two CHP cars were already tearing down that access road with lights and sirens. Shade figured the heavy guns were coming, the military-level response. But they weren't here yet. Just a distant Mini Cooper, two CHP cars, and a helicopter. And me, Shade thought. The superhero. Chapter 16. Shade versus Nightmare. Shade was already morphing as Malik sent the stolen SUV barreling after the CHP. Let me out here, she said in her eerie transformed voice. Malik, for once, did not argue and hit the brakes. Shade was out and gone before the vehicle came to a stop, effortlessly leaping from a moving vehicle and feeling a rush of pure joy from that ability. It was a joy that lasted for a half second before the fear flooded back as the dark watchers made their presence known. The access road was less than half a mile long, a heartbeat for Shade. Ahead was the lighthouse compound, a handful of one-story, red-roofed buildings, a network of trails, some windswept trees, an ancient water tower, and the tall, austere, white-painted lighthouse itself. It was a savagely beautiful location, with waves crashing on rocks and the long sweep of the California coastline to the north and south. Three cars were parked neatly in front of the administrative buildings. The Mini was not so much parked as abandoned and then torn apart, like a steel egg from which a gigantic bird had hatched. And there stood Nightmare. A pretty blonde woman cowered against the nearest wall and covered her head with pale, bruised arms. The CHP cars advanced at what to Shade was a ludicrous crawl. The helicopter's rotors were beating so slowly that Shade could see the individual blades. The woman, Erin O'Day was her name, Shade recalled, was screaming, but the sound was an eerie warble. The creature, Nightmare, stood with claw and sword spread wide in a gesture of defiance. He was massive, not quite twice Shade's height, and wider still, measuring from sword tip to claw tip. He tore apart the Golden Gate Bridge. There was still time to turn around, run back to her friends, save herself. She didn't really have to do this, did she? Run away, live to fight another day. It was the Dark Watchers. They didn't want this fight. The malicious glee was gone, replaced by alarm. They feared what she might do. They fear me. This realization was like a bolt of steel added to her spine. Nightmare was a monster, a villain, a murderer, and the Watchers did not want him hurt. I'm not your puppet. Nightmare was even bigger up close and radiated power and violence. Shade vibrated to a stop, forcing herself to speak slowly. Hey, you should, She had not exactly thought about what to say to the monster. Stop being an asshole. With slowness that tried Shade's patience, the creature turned malevolent, pupilless black eyes on her. What the hell are you? I'm the hero. Shade was pretty sure he would blink at this if he had eyelids. He did not appear to. His eyes were black balls, inhuman, soulless. The CHP arrived, their car doors opened. Two officers were slowly, slowly taking positions behind the cover of their doors, handguns drawn. Go ahead, shoot, you puny nothings, Nightmare bellowed in his crack of doom voice. Bam, 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 bam. The highway patrolmen emptied their clips at point-blank range. Shade saw the bullets flying. She saw the slugs strike their target. She saw them spin away. Guns don't bother him, so what am I supposed to do? Cruz and Malik coasted up in the stolen vehicle, taking their sweet time. Malik and Cruz piled out, slowly. Malik left the engine running, then reached back in and threw it into gear. The SUV crawled forward, just as they'd planned. Shade to distract so that Malik could get the vehicle closer. Well done, Malik. She returned to the SUV in a single bound as Malik was still slowly walking away. She opened the door and climbed in. Her morphed body was a very poor fit for the seat, but she was able to jam one foot down on the accelerator and watch the speedometer move from 8 miles an hour to 20 to 45, at which point the SUV was just a few feet from impact. She leaped out, easily matching what to her was not even walking speed, and watched as the SUV advanced on Nightmare. His dead eyes turned, spotting the SUV, and he began to move. It was a surreal ballet, the SUV advancing at a seeming crawl, Nightmare swinging his sword at a slightly faster pace, SUV, sword, SUV, sword. Shade shifted position to see better. The front bumper was inches from Nightmare's left leg as the sword arm completed an awkward arc. The SUV crashed into Nightmare with a loud crump. Nightmare's sword arm sliced into the SUV behind the driver's seat. Nightmare's leg was slammed by the impact of the big SUV, and he lost his balance. His sword arm had carried him around with its momentum, and now he fell on his back atop the SUV. Erin's unnatural warbling scream rose in pitch. The CHP and the helicopter had their door open and fired down at him with a shotgun, the fat slugs clearly visible as they flew. Shade looked around, searching for some tool, some weapon. By the main highway was a barbed wire fence. She raced back and ripped lengths of wire free, coiling it, then ran back just as Nightmare climbed, apparently unhurt, off the crushed SUV. He glared up at the helicopter and then did something Shade would not have thought possible for a creature of his size and weight. He jumped. Nightmare jumped twice his own height, and at the top of his rise, he swung the sword arm. No! Shade cried in a millisecond buzz. But Nightmare was too high, and the helicopter was too low, and the sword arm smashed into the whirling blades, which shattered and came apart, hurling jagged steel in every direction. Then, the sword's arc cut into the top of the helicopter and down through the passenger space. Shade watched in horror as the blade sliced down through the body of a patrolman, down through his shoulder, down through his chest, out through his hip. The helicopter crashed into one of the administrative buildings, bashing in the red tile roof. Shade saw it all in slow motion with exquisite detail. The tiles flying, the stucco crumbling, the rotor shattering, the pilot struggling with the stick, mouth open, starting to scream. Am I fast enough? Shade ran straight at the disaster. She ducked beneath a stumpy turning rotor, leaped atop a crumbling wall, paused for a millisecond to aim, and threw herself through the air. She landed hard against the near side door of the helicopter, hands scrabbling for purchase, one foot finding a skid, fingers finding the door handle. She yanked the door open, swung into the helicopter's cockpit, started to grab the pilot, saw he was still buckled in, and unsnapped the seatbelt as the glass bubble of the cockpit smashed into crumbling brick. Masonry was pushing its way through the glass. In a heartbeat, the pilot would be dead. "Hang on!" she yelled at morph normal speed, which of course the pilot could not possibly understand. Shade grabbed the pilot by his jacket with one hand, grabbed the door jamb with the other, and shoved off blindly backward. The pilot flew out of his seat, even as Shade saw a wooden beam pierce the glass. The beam was driven so hard into the pilot seat that it pushed all the way through, tearing stuffing and springs out of the back. But the pilot, like Shade, was flying backward through the air. The fall was at normal speed, so Shade had time to wrap her arms around the pilot and twist in midair to take all the impact on her back. She hoped she was strong enough to take it. Whoomph! The landing seemed to take forever, but that did not lessen its impact. She had fallen only 20 feet, perhaps, but still, the wind exploded from her chest, and she lay dazed for a long while, perhaps 3 seconds in real time, before she could suck in air. The pilot lay on his back atop her. She rolled him away. He was dazed, but breathing. Hell yes, superhero, Shade thought. "Are you all right?" she asked, noticing that she had ripped his jacket to shreds. The pilot was not in the mood for conversation. He was more in the mood for incoherent, babbling terror. A pillar of dust and smoke rose from the crashing helicopter, and then something Shade almost did not recognize. The sound of an explosion, a single loud bam, and then a protracted roar as fuel ignited. A piece of steel flew like a scythe toward the stunned pilot. Shade snatched it out of the air. In the meantime, one of the CHP had turned and run in pure animal panic. The other one was emptying his reloaded pistol at Nightmare, but the creature barely noticed him. Shade glanced left and saw more CHP lights coming. But what were they going to do that these doomed patrolmen had not already tried? For only the second time in her life, Shade was suddenly and without training or preparation on the verge of an actual physical fight. And Nightmare was many times more dangerous than the vandals in the cemetery. "I really wish I prayed, because now would be a good time," Shade buzzed. Shade retrieved her cast-off barbed wire and launched herself at Nightmare. She loosely tied one end of the barbed wire around one leg, then ran in a tight circle, looping the wire 5 times around Nightmare's legs before she bounded away to a safe distance. Nightmare tried a step. She could actually watch the dull emotion form on his face, the puzzlement, the worry, the frustration, the fear, as he fell, tripped by the wire. He would break free in seconds, but for Shade, a few seconds was a long time, long enough for her to snatch the pistol from the patrolman's hand, just as he'd slammed in a fresh clip. There was no time for her to register the fact that she had never held a gun in her life before this moment. She ran, bounding, and leaped atop the downed monster. She aimed the gun at his right eye and blam! This time, it was her bullet she watched. It was her bullet that flew harmlessly past Nightmare's eye. Damn! She jumped closer to the eye, which was slowly focusing, dark circles within still darker circles. From a distance of 3 feet, she fired again. This time the copper-jacketed slug plowed into the eye. It dimpled the surface, like a marble dropped on jello, but then the jello exploded outward. The vitreous black goo displaced by the bullet entering the membrane. It was like watching a water balloon filled with ink explode in slow motion. Shade jumped clear, and now the dark watchers seemed almost to be singing, but in discordant tones. as though disagreeing with themselves. The attention was intense, distracting. She panted hard, limbs all leaden, heart pounding like it was trying to break through concrete. The exhaustion was utter, and it gutted her. For a moment, she could only stand as her head swam and her stomach wanted urgently to be sick. Nightmare snapped the barbed wire easily, just so much thread to him. He roared in pain, roared and clapped his claw hand over his face, roared and swung his sword around, trying to hit his nearly invisible foe. Shade had hurt him, but not fatally, not by a long shot. One eye was a black stain, but the other one still worked. Justin Devere might be a violent psychopath, but he was no fool. With a quickness of mind that worried Shade, Nightmare saw his best shot. He turned and bounded away, each stride carrying him 24 feet, straight toward the lighthouse. The lighthouse was on a small, man-made hill. A set of stone steps led up to a surprisingly grand, porticoed entryway, and a narrow door through which Nightmare barely squeezed sideways. By the time Shade had conquered her nausea, Nightmare was all the way inside. Furious at the loss of time, Shade leaped to the lighthouse. It was a leap unlike anything she had tried before. It was as if her thick, morphed thighs contained some kind of spring-loaded mechanism, and it quite simply hurled her through the air, hurled but also tumbled, for she had no way to control her flight. She cartwheeled, head over heels, had plenty of time to see the curved wall of the lighthouse, but absolutely no way to avoid crashing into it. The impact knocked the wind out of her, but was not painful. No, the painful part was when she fell to the ground, banging off the portico. She was mad now. Mad at Nightmare, mad that she couldn't control her body, mad at what felt like some kind of psychic interruption from the Watchers. With one powerful foot, she kicked in the door. Inside, things were much as she expected. There was a small desk and a chair, but really the only important feature was the steel spiral staircase. Counterclockwise, of course. Somewhere Shade had acquired the knowledge that in ancient castles, the spiral staircases always went counterclockwise, because in the old days of sword fighting, you defended your castle from the top down. A spiral that went counterclockwise meant your sword hand, usually your right, was free, while those coming up the stairs had their sword hands cramped. This was one of those pieces of data Shade had never imagined being useful. But, as it happened, she was in a tower, and she was facing, in effect, a swordsman whose sword was on his right. The stairs were narrow. Too narrow for her to squeeze past the lumbering monster above her. He had used the lighthouse to minimize the advantage her speed gave her. Nightmare stopped at a platform halfway up, turned, and aimed his sword arm downward, waving it side to side, daring her to try to get past.
"Who are you?"
Nightmare cried. Shade vibrated to a stop just beyond the slow sweep of his sword arm. "Shade, Darby, pleased to meet you.
Leave me alone."
"Can't. You're the villain, I'm the hero." The silliness of her response would have made Shade laugh at herself if it were not for the rising nausea as ghostly tendrils tickled the boundaries of her mind, prodding, pushing, like blind burglars trying to find an open window.
"It's not my fault. I can't control this creature."
"Yeah, we think that's bullshit. You're talking to me, so you are in control." Nightmare slowly took that on board. His remaining eye glared back hatred at Shade.
"Leave me alone."
His bellow was so loud, Shade worried it could bring the old structure down around their ears. "Can't. Hero, villain, monster, long story." On the one hand, dialoguing with Nightmare gave Shade a moment to rest. On the other hand, they watched. They probed.
"What do you want?"
Shade raged at those dark and distant objects.
"What do you want from me?"
Just a loud buzz to Nightmare. Standing there on the staircase, looking up at an armored freak, reminded Shade of a very important point. She had no natural weapons. She had tossed aside the gun, and now she had only her speed. "Leave him be." The thought came unbidden, and it puzzled Shade. "Leave him be? Leave the monster who had killed a plane load of people and dozens more in the course of destroying the Golden Gate Bridge?" It made some sense. She likely could not stop Nightmare. It made sense to save her own life and those of her friends and get as far away from this terrible creature as she could. And yet, Where exactly did that thought come from?
Yeah, I don't think so, she said, defiant, speaking to creatures who might be nothing but figments of her imagination. Somehow addressing the Dark Watchers made her feel steadier, more herself, stronger. No, no, she was not about to just run away. She had the power she had sought. Her own actions had brought her here. This was another Gaia, a superpowered villain, the very thing superheroes were meant to cope with. Right? Her thoughts went to weapons. The cops outside had guns, but they hadn't been very useful. The only vulnerability Nightmare seemed to have was his eyes. His eyes and maybe that ferocious mouth. Run away. Run away. Live to fight another day. The bit of doggerel was playing on a loop in Shade's mind. Just leave him be. Just turn and go. Live to fight another day. Why the hell should I care what this lunatic does? I'm only playing hero because of Malik. No, that was not true. No, that was not her own thought. That was a thought that came from them. She closed her eyes and looked inward, looked without eyes, with thought alone, at the seething black liquid image. She faced it cleanly, straight on. What do you want from me? What is this game about? Was that a ghostly laugh? Was it a sneer echoing across light years? Nightmare seized the moment as the transformed Shade stared into space, frowning with crinkling plasticine features. He did the unexpected, the awkward. He swept his claw toward her, stabbing it at her. Shade shook off her reverie and sidestepped the blow. But this was what Nightmare expected, and he had already begun the sharp, quick forward thrust of his sword arm. The point came within millimeters of Shade's chest before she twisted and slipped the blow. The sword arm stabbed past her and right through the thick brick wall of the lighthouse. A narrow shaft of daylight entered through the hole. It was through that small hole that Shade saw something puzzling. The CHP vehicles were pulling away. Men on foot were running, and from far away she heard voices yelling, "Shade, run! Run!" Not the Dark Watchers, not this time. That was Cruz and Malik. Shade spun and bounded back down the stairs, racing out the door, shot a look over her shoulder and saw the F-16, high out over the water. She saw the plume of smoke and fire as the F-16's Hellfire missile launched, flew, then veered unstoppably toward the lighthouse. Shade reached the flattened SUV and spotted Malik half in an abandoned CHP car. Cruz was in the back seat. Shade jumped into the passenger seat and began to demorph as the Hellfire, with an enormous crack boom, annihilated the Piedras Blancas lighthouse, turning it into flying rubble. For Shade, the world began to move very fast as she demorphed and sighed with intense relief when the Dark Watchers disappeared from her mind. Malik backed the CHP car up, executed an impressive skidding turn, and went tearing away. "Okay," Cruz said, breathless as they bounced onto the 101. "That was some serious superhero stuff. And now we're stealing a cop car," Malik said. "Better and better."
Chapter 17, Battle of the Lighthouse. This is what Justin Devere, Nightmare, saw. The disturbing half-plastic, half-insect, half-girl had suddenly run away. She was gone. He'd seen her blur quick glance outside, and in a heartbeat she was gone, leaving nothing but a short, sharp blast of air. Why? He followed the direction she looked, out through the hole he'd made in the side of the lighthouse, and saw the police pulling back at top speed. He had a very bad feeling. Nightmare spun, stabbed his sword through the backside of the tower, ripped it up, ripped it sideways, and beat on the wall with his claw. The bricks clattered away, and he was out through the hole and leaping for the ground when he saw the missile, a blur, and actually felt the wind of it inches above his massive shoulder. It hit the tower, and the whole world exploded. There followed a period of blackness. He was vaguely aware, vaguely conscious, but his thoughts were scrambled. He was on his face. There was something heavy on his back. He opened his one eye and saw jagged sections of brick wall piled around him. Erin was there, yanking at him with her weak hands, yelling things he could not hear for the ringing in his ears. But he could watch her lips, her quite pretty lips. Not the time for that, and anyway, what was she saying? Get up? Thoughts and memories all snapped into place, and Justin knew. He shrugged off the tons of debris and struggled to his feet. Did the Dark Watchers just cheer? On his feet, feeling the pain in his eye and the new pain in his back, but defiant and with a growing rage inside him, Justin spread his arms, threw back his head, and roared, "You cannot stop me! I am Nightmare!" Aaron was there, yelling, and as the ringing in his ears quieted, he began to hear, "It's the girl from Iowa! It's a girl from Iowa!" And the penny dropped as Justin realized what she was saying and who he had just faced down in battle. The speed demon was the girl from the field in Iowa. The girl who now apparently had acquired super speed and a desire to meddle in the affairs of Nightmare. "You're the villain. I'm the hero." Justin pushed away the pain in his eye, or told himself to at least. The pain was terrible and absolutely impossible to ignore. Her name, that unusual name, came to him and he bellowed, "Come and get me, Shade Darby. Come and fight Nightmare." "I'm not the villain. I'm the artist." But the speed demon and her friends had hopped into a CHP car, slammed into reverse, and were racing at speed for the main road as more vehicles, with flashing lights, closed in from north and south. The F-16 circled to come around for another attack, and now, flying low over the water, came two Apache attack helicopters. For a moment, Justin wanted to cry, "It's not fair." Aaron was just beside him, pleading with him to run, run, run. But he was weary, and though he was fast, he was not the girl from the Iowa cornfield, and he could not hope to outrun the missiles he saw already arcing with deadly grace toward him. "Sorry," he said to Aaron. She seemed puzzled. Her eyes widened, and there were three massive explosions. Justin regained consciousness as Justin, no longer Nightmare. He could tell that he was in the back of a tractor trailer. The dimensions of the long rectangle were the dimensions of every trailer on the highway, and he felt the vibrations of wheels on tarmac, heard the diesel engine, and the sound of wind. He was on his back, naked, on a stainless steel table. Titanium bands 2 inches thick clasped his neck, elbows, waist, thighs, and ankles, and there were heavy cement blocks encasing his hands. No. 4 people in army uniforms and maroon berets had 4 automatic assault rifles aimed at him. A middle-aged woman, in an impeccable razor-creased uniform, stood watching with avid eyes. The uniform was adorned with small blue and gold rectangles, framing a single brass star on the shoulders. "You would be Justin Devere," the general said. "I'm General DeMarco. Your girlfriend is Vapor, thanks to you."
"Aaron," he moaned.
"Let's get this straight right from the start, you little psycho. Each and every time you address me, you will do so as General or Ma'am." She leaned down close, close enough for him to notice a twitch in her right eye.
Is she dead?"
The general smiled, showing too many small white teeth. Then she grabbed his nose between thumb and forefinger and twisted it viciously. He cried out and she twisted again, wringing a louder cry of pain from him.
"What did I just tell you? Is she dead, General?"
"Dead or in hell, Private. Dead or in hell. You are all alone in the world, Private Devere. All alone in the great cruel world."
"Why do you keep calling me Private? General, Ma'am?"
DeMarco patted him on the side of his face.
"Well, son, it's like this. Although we don't use it, we do still have the draft on the books. So you, you sick piece of shit, are now a private in the U.S. Army."
What, General?
"Very good. You learn. I like 'em bright. Easier to train that way."
"But I'm not..."
The memory of their plan, the one that involved pretending that he had no control over Nightmare, came back like a life preserver tossed to a drowning man.
"I'm not him, General. I can't control him, Ma'am."
DeMarco laughed. It was a surprisingly nice laugh, full of genuine warmth and perhaps even a touch of maternal concern. But her voice, when she spoke, carried no such warmth.
Listen to me, Private, and listen good. You have two choices going forward. Choice number one is you work for me.
Justin was about to ask what choice number two was, but a glance at his own helplessness and the barrels of four expertly handled automatic weapons left no doubt about alternative number two. He sagged, exhausted, depressed, beaten, utterly beaten. Aaron, dead. He was alone, all alone, with the whole world out to kill him.
I guess I work for you, he muttered under his breath, then quickly added, General.
Welcome to the war, Private, DeMarco said with obvious satisfaction. Welcome to World War III.
Aboard the Okeanos Explorer. The combination was 849-661. It was amazing what high-def video could capture. 2 days passed, during which the Okeanos, escorted by elements of the U.S. Navy and watched minutely by satellites belonging to most of the major nations on Earth, carried its precious cargo toward the port of Los Angeles. They were just 48 hours out of Los Angeles when a storm came up from the south and lashed the ship with near-horizontal rain. Visibility was down to less than a mile, and all hands were busy working the ship. The box was guarded 24 hours a day by an armed member of the security detail, but when hiring the contractors, HSTF-66 had overlooked one small matter. Three of them suffered terribly from seasickness, especially with the ship moving like a roller coaster. So the box was unguarded for 3 hours, and that was more than enough. Vincent Vu punched in the combination and slipped inside. He had a flashlight, his camera, and a ball-peen hammer he had swiped from the bosun. He spent some time taking pictures, but the rock was a massive gray lump inside a massive gray box, and there wasn't much he could do with that. He could, however, use the cover provided by a howling wind to chip off a goodly sized chunk of rock, which he took back to the hammock that had been slung for him in one of the storerooms. By this point, Vincent, like everyone aboard except for the largely deaf cook, knew what the rock was. He had overheard nervous jokes from scientists talking about what the rock might do. Talk of mutations, superpowers, a world on the brink of a revolution that might cause all of civilization to crumble. All that sounded good to Vincent Vu. The voices in his head liked it too. He had no mortar and pestle, so he had to smash the rock as well as he could with the hammer, scooping up the flakes and crumbs with his student ID. Then, falling into a depressive state, he did nothing for the better part of a day. But when he woke in the middle of the night, feeling himself elevated into a manic state, feeling a sudden urgent need, he swallowed what he had, choking it down as the larger chunk scarred his throat. In the end, 5 ounces of rock found its way to Vincent's stomach. He went to sleep after a while and dreamed of a strange sort of argument. The voices in his head were arguing with a new voice, but one that did not quite make sounds. No, this new voice did not speak, but made itself felt, and that feeling was of vast emptiness, of impossible distances, but at the same time, of intimacy so immediate, it felt as if this new force had cowed his old voices. Those voices, the auditory hallucinations of his schizophrenia, faded. They did not go away, but they spoke now sotto voce, in hurried, frightened whispers. The new voice, the voiceless voice, was less angry than his hallucinations. These dark things, these distant yet intimate things, did not touch his auditory centers, but seemed to speak directly to his emotions. Vincent felt that they liked him. He felt that they had high hopes for him, and he felt, somewhat to his surprise, since he had never quite bought into the hallucinations in which he appeared as Abaddon, that these dark watchers agreed that they were content to have him truly become Abaddon. When he woke from the dream, Vincent found reality stranger by far, for unless this was some new hallucination, he was changing in dramatic, extreme ways. Chapter 18, Going Home. Decca was in a hurry to get to the last place on Earth she'd ever expected to visit again. She was on Highway 1, throttle almost all the way open, her Kawasaki throbbing steadily between her thighs, and a large white boy with one powerful arm around her waist. The speedometer read 90 miles an hour, and the road sign said it was another 50 miles to Perdido Beach. She had no phone and no apps, and thus nothing to warn her of police roadblocks or speed traps ahead. She hoped the BOLO for her had expired, or that something more urgent was occupying the authorities, and she was being smart, spending the better part of 2 days crawling southward on back roads, some no more than dirt tracks, and sleeping one night in a winery shed that smelled of fruit and mold, and the other night in a tumble-down hunter's shack. To her relief, Armo had been a decent traveling companion. He seldom spoke, he asked no questions, and he had managed to procure food for their overnight stay by raiding a nearby farm. He had also purloined a pair of denim overalls that were about 6 inches too short. Shoes remained a problem. He wore size 13E. But he'd found a pair of flip-flops that were too small but slightly better than nothing. He was less conspicuous than he'd been in nothing but stretched-out boxers, but he was still something of a spectacle. After much careful evasion, Decca had rejoined Highway 1, the famous Pacific Coast Highway, planning to stay with it through the gloom of the Stefano Rey National Park and past the nuclear plant, and from there to Perdido Beach along the back roads that eventually became Ocean Boulevard. A Xylo song kept going through her head. We're diving in the deep end. We can't turn back again. She was between the devil, Tom Peaks, and the deep blue sea of painful memories and lingering terror that was Perdido Beach. She had not yet found a convenient excuse to dump Armo, and truth be told, she did not entirely mind having him around. He had certainly been formidable in taking down the helicopter. The only problem was getting him to do anything that was not his idea. She had quickly learned that she could suggest to Armo, "Armo, would you be willing to fill the tank while I go take a pee?" but could not order him to do anything, even things he wanted to do. While sneaking up on an isolated farm, she had had the following conversation. "Armo, go left, I'll go right. You go left. Left is darker and you stand out more in the light." "Yeah, so go left." Long Armo silence, an outthrust, pouting lip. "Okay, which way do you think you should go?" Shorter Armo silence, followed by, "I should go left, it's darker." Brief Decca silence. "All right then, good idea." But there was, despite this, something charming about Armo, who was not bright or even slightly cooperative, but was also not a jerk or a sexist or a racist or any other form of ist, unless it was defiantist, which was probably not a word. And really, Decca had to admit, she was hardly the easiest person to get along with either. She might not have Armo's extreme ODD, but instinctive defiance was definitely part of her makeup. And the nice thing was that Armo extended the same extreme courtesy to her, never ordering, only suggesting or wondering aloud. Suddenly, through her helmet and the thrum of the engine, she heard sirens, and they were coming closer. She looked left and right, but the highway was flanked by low hills, all covered in scrub grass and squat bushes. There was no place to hide the bike or herself, no turnoffs, no businesses to slip into, nothing. "Maybe I should," Armo said, leaving it open. In her rearview mirror, Decca saw two CHP vehicles practically levitating as they topped rises and bounced through dips, seconds away. Could she outrun them? Maybe, but not for long. They would radio ahead for a roadblock or call for a helicopter. And on four wheels, they were probably more stable than she was, especially with 200 pounds of passenger. One pothole, and she would go tumbling down the road. The nearest CHP flashed its headlights and gave the siren a whoop, whoop, whoop. And Decca realized with infinite relief that they were simply warning her to move aside. She slowed onto the shoulder, and the cars flew past. "Now I just need to get my stomach back down out of my throat," Decca muttered. "Hey, where are we headed?" Armo asked.
I'm heading to Perdido Beach. Would you like to come?
Sure. She headed south again, going fast, but not so fast she looked as if she was chasing the CHP, which, in any event, were soon out of sight around a curve. Out of sight, but not for long. She motored past an abandoned roadside motel and a sign announcing a scenic lighthouse ahead. Seconds later, she saw not a lighthouse, but a pillar of smoke, and a military helicopter landing, and what must be every emergency or police vehicle within 50 miles. It looked as if the CHP were starting to set up a roadblock on the PCH, but she was there ahead of them. She gave a saucy wave and passed by, unchallenged.
What the hell was that?
Armo shouted above the engine.
I don't think we should stop and ask,
Decca said, then added, What do you think?
I don't think we should stop and ask. At least we know every CHP in the area is busy.
They came at last to the edge of Stefano Rey National Forest and passed a CHP car driven not by California Highway Patrol troopers, but by a young black man with two white-looking kids as passengers.
There's a story there, Decca said before accelerating past them.
Into the forest, into deep shade with a watery autumn sun strobed by the trees. Decca's stomach churned, and her breath came short and too fast. It was near now. She was already within the diameter of what had been the phase. She slowed without really meaning to, her throttle a reflection of her state of mind. Still, she missed the turnoff and had to come back around to find it. Now the SUV she'd passed earlier passed her, still heading south. Then she was at the edge of town. She pulled over to the side of the road, just to let the feelings wash through her. This place, the people, the horror. She felt as though if she went any farther, she would be trapped. She'd been within the phase ever since she entered the forest. But for Decca, the phase meant, above all, the town of Perdido Beach. This was where she had fought. This was where she had starved and had been thrilled to have a rat leg to eat. This was where she first met Sam Temple, Adelio, Lana. This is where she had loved Brianna. The breeze. She slowed to low gear like a motorcycle at a parade. She kept her helmet on less for safety than in the paranoid sense that someone might recognize her. This was an old home week for Decca. This was a return visit to hell.
And yet, didn't you enjoy parts of it?
By the end of the phase, the town had been largely burned down, hundreds of homes lost. The businesses had all been looted and gutted. Since then, much had been rebuilt. The traffic lights worked. The street signs had been put back up. The shattered storefront windows were all plate glass again. There was light traffic, a strangely surreal sight to Decca. During the phase, gasoline had quickly become scarce, and any vehicle you saw either was Adelio and one of his militia, or it signaled some kind of trouble.
Hey, what exactly is this place?
Armo asked.
The phase, Decca said, then with a sigh. The Perdido Beach anomaly, the PBA.
Okay, cool, Armo said, apparently satisfied. They came to the town square, site of so many bloody battles, site of so much horror and death. The town square had been the symbolic heart of the phase. A boy named Adelio, who had started his life in the phase as an undocumented kid with no friends and zero status, had become the single most trusted and relied upon person in the phase. If Decca had been Sam Temple's strong right arm, Adelio had been his endlessly competent executive officer, his rock-solid support, and at times, his conscience. It was Adelio who had taken on himself the job of burying the dead. Adelio had dug the graves and fashioned the simple markers and stood by those graves with bowed head, asking God to watch over the souls of the dead. To Decca's amazement and gratification, those graves had not been removed. On the contrary, someone had arranged for stone grave markers to be erected in place of the wooden crosses and awkward stars of David and the one-week effort at a Muslim crescent that had marked those shallow graves. She parked her bike.
This part I do alone, she said, then amending, unless you'd like to come.
Armo did not want to come. He climbed off the bike and headed toward the McDonald's. Deka walked on trembling legs to the graves. An informational marker had been set up. In raised bronze letters, it read, in respectful memory of both the wise and the foolish who struggled to survive unspeakable horror in this place. And in smaller letters, this space is maintained by the Albert Hillsborough Foundation. That brought a rueful smile to Deka's lips. Albert the capitalist, the businessman, the hustler. Lord, how she had hated him at times. But with later reflection, she had come to realize that while Sam Temple might be the warrior hero, and Adelio, the capable, brave, and moral, day-in, day-out manager, it was Albert who had fed and watered the kids and kept them alive. She raised a hand in a small salute. Good for you, Albert. Good for you. And then, with every fiber of her being suffused with a leaden resistance, she moved among the tombstones. Names she knew. Mary Terrafino, who had been a saint until mental illness had taken her over the edge. Duck Zhang, just a nice kid who'd been given a power he never wanted. Poor Hunter. And Charles Merriman, who had carried the nickname Orc. Orc the bully. Orc the drunk. Orc the murderer. Orc the redeemed Christian, who at the end had sacrificed his life to save others. There hadn't been much of a body left, and Deka wondered just what Albert found to bury. But that was not really important, and Deka laid a hand on Orc's tombstone. Better late than never, Orc. You died well. Cain had died just minutes before the end of the phase, and there had been nothing but dust to bury. But Albert had nevertheless given him a stone that read, Cain Sorin, King of the Phase, Blaze of Glory. Damn it. Deka brushed tears away. Really, Deka? Really? Shedding tears for Cain? Half the bodies in the graveyard were there because of Cain Sorin. Cain, the bad boy. Cain, the unloved son. Cain, the abandoned brother of Sam. Cain, the power mad, the grandiose, the ruthless. Cain, who so loved Diana Ladris that he gave his life for her and for all of them. And finally, there it was, what she was looking for and what she dreaded finding. Brianna Berenson, the breeze, none more bold. Deka's entire body shook with emotion, her mouth an ugly grimace of pain and regret. And now, the tears could not be brushed away. They came too fast, and she did not wish to brush them away. She wanted her tears to fall here, on this ground, a small offering. Deka fell to her knees, leaned against the cool stone, and sobbed.
I'm so sorry, Breeze. I'm so sorry I haven't come earlier. I was too weak. I didn't want it. I keep your picture with me all the time. I haven't stopped. I still love you. I will always love you. It's okay that it was one way, Breeze. All I ever needed was to love you.
After a long while, she stood up and dried her face on her sleeve.
This goddamn place,
Deka said quietly. This bloody goddamned place. She saw that the church had been partly rebuilt, but only partly, and the scaffolding looked old and unused, as though the project had been abandoned. The town hall was in better shape, but there was only a single car parked in front, and it did not look like a place that had much going on. The McDonald's that Albert had kept open for a while after the start of the phase had been rebuilt to shiny new perfection. But even there she saw signs of neglect. Litter on the sidewalks. A cracked window. Hello, Deka. Deka knew the voice even before she turned. Diana Ladris was still beautiful, though she looked years older than her actual age.
Her dark eyes were haunted, her voice quiet and respectful. But there, at the corners of those ever-alluring lips, was still a hint of the old Diana, wry and amused. Diana, I did not expect to find you here.
Diana jerked her chin toward a small hatchback parked a few spaces from the red Kawasaki where Armo lounged, shoving a Big Mac into his face. Flowers were visible inside the little car, and flowers were in Diana's hand.
I come once a week, whenever I can, to put flowers on the graves. I had just cleared away the faded ones when I saw you.
Diana laid the bouquet at the base of Brianna's tombstone, and now Deca would have cried again, had she any tears left.
I should have, Deca began.
Nah, Diana said.
No should-haves, okay?
They taught me that in therapy. Don't waste time regretting. Just find a way to undo whatever harm you've done as well as you can. This is my thing, my little penance.
How have you been, Diana?
Diana shrugged.
I have a job.
You are looking at a semi-competent Pete's barista. I have my own place, finally. The wry smile appeared. I am 7 months and 3 days sober, and I haven't tried to kill myself lately. You?
Deca hesitated before answering. The vacuous fine was on the tip of her tongue, but she owed Diana more than that.
Diana was one of the very few people she could talk to about what was happening without being taken for a madwoman.
Got a few minutes?
Deca asked wearily.
Help me place the flowers and we'll talk.
Deca smiled at that, happy to help, happy to have a few minutes to collect her thoughts. When they were finished, the two of them walked the few blocks to the beach. Armo followed at a discreet distance, like a bodyguard. The beach was as long and beautiful as ever, curving away to the northwest. The debris of Albert's water purification device was gone.
Deca shaded her hand against the lowering sun and looked southeast.
Have they got Clifftop open?
Diana said. It's a Sheraton now.
Huh.
The bar there serves themed cocktails. The Faze, the PBA, the Sam Temple. That's something with vodka and limoncello for some reason. The Lana is vodka and some nasty green tea drink, you know, for healing, supposedly.
You and I didn't rate.
Deca shook her head slowly.
I guess the irony that phasers have a tendency to drink too much is lost on them.
Big hotel chains don't do irony, Diana said. She led them to a bench, and the two old, not exactly friends, sat side by side and looked out at the ocean as the horizon rose to meet a reddening sun. Without further preamble, Diana said,
you're in some kind of trouble.
How do you figure?
Suddenly you're back here, and you're actually talking?
Deca Talent, who had never been known to speak more than a dozen words a day.
Deca smiled. Well, I'm all about action.
And I guess, you know, there's a big white dude in sad overalls following us.
Yeah, I sort of picked him up along the way.
She sighed heavily.
He's all right, so long as you don't try to tell him what to do. The boy makes me seem easygoing.
Diana laughed. Right, you, easygoing.
Diana, Deca said, her grin disappearing. It's all starting again, but this time it's not just a 20-mile-across dome. It's the whole world.
She told Diana all she'd seen, all she knew. From time to time, she glanced at Diana and saw the young woman's face grow red from the sunset, then dark from shadows, and darker still from concern that deepened into worry.
Well, that's all bad news, Diana said at last.
You were good to keep Sam and Astrid out of it.
Yeah, well, now that I've gone rogue, HSTF-66 may take a run at him,
Deca said regretfully.
But I didn't have a choice, Diana. Peaks and his whole operation are an atrocity.
So now you're right back in it, Diana said.
Yeah, I noticed.
In the old days, I could have held your hand and told whether you were a 3-bar or a 4 or 5.
5, Deca said flatly. Maybe 6, if there is such a thing.
This power is... it's incredible. But each time I use it, I have to change into this thing, this creature. And when I'm morphed, I sense...
She shook her head. It's something dark, Diana. Very dark. It watches. Sometimes it's like it's laughing. Other times it's annoyed or impatient with me.
You didn't just come here for old time's sake, Diana said.
You came to see if it is still alive.
Deca nodded slowly.
They've closed the mineshaft, Diana said. At first, they had crews down in there, but various bad things happened, so they blew up the shaft. They sealed it up like they meant it this time. Concrete,
Deca said.
They took it. They dug it out. That's the only answer. HSFTF-66 has whatever is left of the Gaia Phage.
I should have realized that's what they were using for their god-awful experiments.
Jesus, Diana. They put some of the Gaia Phage in me. Part of the thing that made Gaia, the thing that killed...
Damn it. Will I ever be able to say it without choking up?
Peaks tried to tell me there was still something dark and sinister in Perdido Beach,
Deca said, back on less emotionally draining turf.
There is, Diana said. The town is still about half empty. Drive through the neighborhoods, and you see houses half rebuilt, then abandoned. The school's running again, but they're closing it next year for lack of students. No one even tried to reopen Coates Academy. I guess when your private school lists alumni that include Kane and Drake and me. Anyway.
No, it's not all gone. There's something still here, like a sort of echo. A memory of what happened here. The whole town is like a graveyard, not just the square. It creeps people out.
You know about the shootout?
Which one?
Bunch of bikers. Gang type, not weekend riders. And cops. Like a year ago, before they sealed the mine.
Bikers had moved in, set up a kind of camp. They were actually conducting tours down to see the rock. Cops rousted them, and there was a gun battle. Bunch of the bikers were arrested. 2 died.
That never made the news.
Diana formed her wry, seen-it-all smile. Yes, news out of Perdido Beach tends not to be widely covered. The whole world wants to forget this place, Deca.
Don't we all? But I'm afraid the world is about to get a wake-up call.
So, what do you do next? Diana asked. Deca took her time considering her answer.
Peaks and HSTF-66 want to keep the whole thing quiet so they can create their own army of superpowered warriors. Supposedly just to stop whoever might get their hands on the rock.
She shook her head.
But that's bullshit. The government wants the power and doesn't want anyone else to have it, and that scares me. The Mother Rock is supposedly heading to L.A.
Once they have that, Deca shrugged.
Are you sure it's a bad thing? The government having the rock?
I mean, they are the government.
Deca kicked at the sand with her toe. What they're doing at the ranch, that's way past anything a government is supposed to do. They're experimenting on people, doing awful things, nightmare stuff. No, that's not a government I need to obey.
They walked back to the town square in silence, both young women lost in thought and memory. Armo went ahead and now waited by the motorcycle.
Diana?
Armo, Deca said.
They shook hands.
Deca offered no further introductions or explanations. Then Deca offered Diana her hand. Diana took it solemnly and held it for a moment.
Take care of yourself, Deca.
There's one thing your Peaks person was not wrong about. If anyone can be trusted with this power, it's you.
If, Deca added silently, recalling the dark and distant whispers.
If.
Hey, I thought of something, Armo said as they crossed what had been the southern border of the dome. He was behind her on the bike, which put his mouth near her ear. She'd lost her helmet along the way, and now her dread streamed back, whipping at his face, so he hunched close to avoid being whipped. His powerful arms were around her waist, and his hard chest was against her back. This is the most intimate I've ever been with a dude, Dekka thought. Meh.
Like what? Asked Dekka.
I made a promise to see Carl's family, but first I wanted to, I don't know, I had to see Perdido Beach. I couldn't just drive on by.
So, what are you up for?
Up for? She had to yell to be heard over the engine and the wind and the steady rhythm of tires on concrete.
I mean, are you hiding or are you fighting?
Dekka breathed a small laugh. You have a nice way of getting to the point, Armo. She rode on, silent, lost in thought. Well, she asked herself, what are you doing, Dekka? Are you hiding or are you fighting? Part of her desperately wanted to find Sam and Astrid. She'd been Sam's sidekick. She'd never before been the one making all the decisions. She, like most of the kids of the phase, had left that burden on his shoulders. No, she wasn't doing that to Sam. Finally, Armo tired of waiting on her.
Want to know what I've been thinking?
Yeah.
The port of Los Angeles.
Dekka digested that for more than a minute, couldn't figure it out, and said,
Why?
Because people think they can drug a guy like me, but they can't. And I hear things people don't think I hear,
Armo said smugly.
The big one, the big rock, the mother rock, DeMarco calls it. That's where it's going. L.A.
A warning light went on in Dekka's head. Something wrong about going to the port of Los Angeles. No, not something wrong exactly, more that it sounded familiar, like she'd heard the suggestion before, like it had been whispered to her in a dream.
I mean, Armo added, assuming you're going to choose fight over hide.
Why assume that? Armo laughed. He had a nice laugh.
Well, hey, I don't know you, but I'm kind of thinking you don't seem much like a girl who hides.
Oh, but I have been hiding, she thought. I've been hiding for 4 years. It came to her then that if she couldn't talk to Sam, she could still guess what his answer would be. His and Brianna's. Neither of us has a phone, Dekka said. We should pick up a map.
A map to where?
A map to you know damn well where, Dekka said, and Armo laughed into her ear.
Chapter 19. Meet the Psychopath. Peaks lay on his back, staring up at a darkening sky. He was shattered. He picked himself up slowly, not bothering to brush away the dirt that clung to him. He had done it. He had become something. Something very much not human. Something huge and hugely strong. Something brutal and indestructible. He looked around at a scene of awesome destruction. Thank God he had the sense to find an isolated place, driving well out into the desert. Because everything within 100 yards had been crushed, ripped apart, thrown, or burned. The ubiquitous tumbleweeds? Scorched. The nearest Joshua tree? Kindling. The sand itself was gouged or dusted with ash, or in a few places had been crystallized, turned to brown glass by extreme heat. Very extreme heat. Peaks had gone to the ranch, told a few close associates about the change in command while putting a happy face on it and fooling no one. Then Peaks had spent a couple of hours downloading the contents of the computer onto a hard drive, his insurance policy, if DeMarco and the rest of them ever tried to throw him under the bus for all the, well, questionable judgment calls he'd made. And he purloined another pound of ground rock. He had left just in time, it seemed, since his successor, now his superior, had been diverted to a battle at the Piedras Blancas lighthouse, and would be delaying her arrival at the ranch. A battle Peaks suspected involved the art student calling himself Nightmare.
DeMarco's problem now, not mine.
Then, Peaks had flown down to Palm Springs, rented a car, and driven out into the desert. He had followed highways, and then roads, and then dirt tracks, out into the middle of nowhere. Out to where there was nothing in view but the austere scalloped hills, the desiccated scrub, and the occasional lizard. There he had given full vent to his rage, his sense of betrayal, his thirst for what he saw as justice and another person might have called revenge. And in his rage, he had become a monster. He had reveled in the extraordinary power. He had tested these new gifts. And he had felt the eyeless gaze of dark watchers. Then he had returned to human form, shaken, overwhelmed, scared, and yet excited. He had become what he had been tasked to destroy, and now he would destroy those others one by one. The Darby girl and those with her, the traitor Dekka, Justin Nightmare, if DeMarco had somehow failed to kill him, and anyone else who opposed him. His mission was vindication. He would prove that he and he alone was capable of addressing the threat to all of humanity and all of human civilization. He was far greater, far more powerful than any of the weapons, biological or mechanical, that he had overseen at the ranch. "I am the most powerful single creature ever to walk the earth." He was fascinated by the process. After all, Peaks was not just an administrator. He had degrees in the fields of nanotechnology and zoology. But one thing was clear. Lacking the support of HSTF-66, temporarily at least, he reassured himself, he needed an ally, at least one. No matter how powerful his own morph was, Peaks knew he could not see in every direction at once. He needed someone to watch his back, someone to throw into battle at just the right time, to tip the scales, someone to launch